From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. As always, thanks for joining us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We'll start this week with Greg Louganis, one of the greatest Olympic athletes of all time. He won 4 gold medals in the 1980s for diving, and he's now 58 years old and was in Rochester to film an episode of Second Opinion, which you can see on WXXI TV this coming November.
Now, Louganis was diagnosed with HIV in 1988, 3 years after he came out as a gay athlete. But coming out was not easy. Here's Louganis telling the story of what it was like for gay athletes a generation ago.
I can look at my diving career and, yeah, I was at a competition and it was like the Fag Buster campaign. And so a friend of mine was so upset, you know, she's tearing down these signs and, she, you know, I went to her and I said, why are you so upset? She said, oh, you know, these divers are so small-minded. And I said, you mean the Fagbuster campaign? I said, oh, how do you know about that? It's like, oh, you missed the signs in the men's room. So she didn't get to the men's room. But, you know, I knew about that. And what's interesting, as time has passed, and I've been in touch with a lot of these people, I don't know how much of it was really true homophobia and how much of it was jealousy because I was winning. And I think the majority of it was that I was winning. It was jealousy. Because they really didn't have a problem with my sexual identity. I can name one that I can say wasn't quite the case, but...
Okay, but I think that's encouraging.
Yeah.
And for the listeners who may not know the context, this was in the 80s when the movie Ghostbusters was popular.
Yes.
And so the campaign that you described, they were actually using Ghostbusters-like signs?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So it was Fag with the Ghostbusters not sign.
Very
through.
Very clever.
Yeah.
You also have said that while you were dealing with that from other divers, you had an agency, Philip Morris?
William Morris. Yeah.
Not the smoking.
Philip Morris is cigarettes.
It'd be weird if you were repped by them as a world-class athlete. William Morris, who...
Well, Mission Viejo was.
What's that?
Mission Viejo, Natadores was. I mean, that was a part of the conglomerate.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, look at all the assumptions. Wow.
You know?
Okay.
but they also did golf, and they also
Okay,
NASCAR.
But, yeah, I just don't think you want to have a sculpted body and be an Olympic diver. Grab a cigarette. But with William Morris in the mid '80s, you know, you're still navigating what it meant to be out, and it sounds to me like you were the kind of athlete who. Your coming out in the 80s wasn't like a declaration moment.
No.
You just started living that way. But then people started talking to you like, hey, tell me a little bit about what that was like from the agency repping standpoint.
I mean, I was out to my family and friends.
Yeah.
They knew about who I was, you know, my identity. You know, in diving, it was pretty well known about my sexual identity. And then when I signed on with the William Morris Agency, then they said, well, just tone down the gay thing. And so I was like, oh, okay. And so it was just my policy not to discuss my personal life in the media.
Is that what they meant? When somebody says to you, tone down the gay thing, what does that actually mean?
I really didn't know. I mean, in a sense, you can interpret that as, you know, okay, we want you back in the closet or don't talk about this or, you know, giving limitations of what, you know, what you're going to share with people. So... my interpretation of it was just not to discuss my personal life with members of the media. And, you know, I felt that, you know, that's fair because everybody's entitled to a personal life. You know, not everything has to be out there. And that's kind of how I kind of justified it in my mind. But that's why I really applaud Matthew Mitchum. He was a diver from Australia. Won the Olympic gold medal in Beijing, of all places, against the Chinese. And he came out while he was competing in this sport because he felt like he couldn't be as good as he wanted to be only by sharing a portion of himself. And to be, you know, true to himself, authentic to himself. So that's the reason why he came out. And it was that the coverage of that Olympic Games was on Matthew Mitchum was a little disappointing. You know, they never acknowledged his partner or his, they called him his special friend, and they kind of danced around the whole thing. that's where you kind of see, you know, there's a lot of education that needs to happen.
Next up, the Supreme Court made a big decision on gambling this week. The court ruled that a federal law banning sports betting is unconstitutional. And that means it's now up to individual states, and many states will try to pass sports gambling legislation. We could see it in New York State as soon as this fall.
We talked to many people on different sides of the issue. First, you'll hear Carl Delafave, who is in recovery for compulsive gambling. Then you'll hear Henry Witosik, the CEO of Off Track Betting of Western New York.
Well, I'm a compulsive gambler that's been in successful recovery since December 28th, 2009. And for me, casino gambling was my thing, but it has a lot in common with people that I know that were sports bettors or scratch-off people, people who went to OTB. I didn't wake up one day and decide, I'm going to be a compulsive gambler. It's a progressive thing. It starts out with small bets in small ways and works through larger bets in larger ways. And I found for me that the more accessible gambling was to me, the more I loved it. And I got to the point where I couldn't stop. And I needed help. I looked for help, I found help, and I've been able to make my life much better because I've stopped gambling. The sports gambling that we're talking about is a freight train that's been coming down the tracks for quite a while. Yeah, I think it's just inevitable that eventually it's going to happen. But all we seem to be talking about is the money. How many billions of dollars are involved? There's a lot of lives involved, too. A certain percentage of the people that start sports gambling are going to turn into compulsive gamblers. It may not happen overnight, and a lot of people won't. It'll just be a fun little pastime for them. Good. But for the people that it turns into a real problem, those problems can escalate way out of control, and it may not take very long before they find themselves in financial difficulty, in emotional difficulty. And really, to just talk about the billions of dollars that are involved and the money that the state's going to make really misses part of the picture. There's a human cost involved in all of this, and I think we really need to address that human cost. Whether it's more treatment for people that fall into compulsive gambling. You know, when I first looked for help, there weren't a lot of options. There are a few more now. And I would hope that when the state of New York gets around to writing their rules and regulations, that they include help for compulsive gambling programs.
Okay, well, before I get to some of your phone calls, Greg in Penfield, among others, please stay there. We want to come to you in a moment here. I do want to ask Henry Witosik, CEO of Off Track Betting, you know, how you feel about someone like Carl, who is sharing that he didn't wake up one morning wanting to become a compulsive gambler, and that there was a deep family, personal, and emotional cost to him, and he's thinking about others who might end up in a similar position. As the CEO of OTB, how do you sort of grapple with that, and what happens when sports gambling is legal?
It's a very tough story, and it's something obviously we take very seriously where we are. And the state of New York, I have to give them a lot of credit. Their gaming commission is very serious about the exclusion programs that we have here. Some are voluntary, some are involuntary, but you better toe the line when somebody tells you that they have a problem. You know, they will come after you if there's any kind of solicitation of them or any kind of, you have to really treat this very seriously and make sure that you're not causing them more of a problem. But I would argue that I think you're going to see the things come out more in the light. I mean, I've known some bookies over the years, and you know, the one thing they continue to say is, hey, you guys can legalize this thing, but we're not in bad shape because we extend credit, which I think causes problems in and of itself. I mean,
explain to our listeners how that works.
You call up a bookie and you say, you know, there's no money down, there's no money out of your pocket, and all of a sudden, you know, clearly when you have to go to these places, you have to have money on you to pay for it. I mean, here you could run into the thousands and thousands of dollars just on a credit alone.
That you don't have.
That you don't have. And
so you think we can wipe that out?
Well, I think it's certainly headed in that direction. If it's somebody has to come to a place and that money has to come out of their pocket somewhere, they're not, again, on an extended number of credit with the illegal bookmakers. That's been a problem. It's led to violence and other things over the years. So I do think that's a positive. But I think more so New York State is very serious about dealing with problem gaming and nipping it in the bud. If someone feels they have a problem, once they say they have a problem and they sign a piece of paper and say, I wish to be excluded for a year or 3 years or 5 years, that's it. There's no coming back. They can't come back in 6 months and say, oh, I was wrong. They sign that paper, they are not allowed to come back in. And I think that's a very important thing. It's a big step for New York State to take, and they've taken that in the last couple of years.
All right, Carl, when you think about that extension of credit that does exist, as Henry's pointing out there, is that a possible positive here, that we would bring this into the light, as he says, and maybe stop or tamp down on this idea that you're going to put yourself in thousands upon thousands of dollars in the hole that you don't have?
I don't think it's going to make any difference whether you're betting with a bookie or betting with a credit card. I ran up all my credit cards way up past their maxes, lines of credit, all those things. I built an economic house of cards out of the perfectly acceptable credit that I already had. And when that house of cards came crashing down, I didn't have any more opportunities to borrow money or any more lines of credit. That's when I finally had to face the fact that I had a problem.
Okay. What about what New York State does for people who are in that category of problem gamblers? Do you see support and resources for that? Could that be part of this solution as well if we're going to see sports betting legalized?
Well, the support system has started to get better. Right now, on every slot machine, there's a tax. And that tax goes to help support compulsive gambling problem programs. I think there needs to be a lot more. There needs to be, if we advertised that there's help for compulsive gamblers as much as we advertise that there's, you know, opportunities to go out and gamble and have fun doing it, I think that a lot more people would realize that they do have a problem and reach out for help.
For you, when did you know? I mean, were your bank accounts empty? Did you have to have a conversation with family? When did you really know? Because you cited a date that you felt was your sort of bottoming out. How did you know?
I went to Turning Stone Casino, and I sat down at my favorite table, and I knew I was there with money that I shouldn't have had with me, but it didn't make any difference. And I played all night, lost everything, and I literally didn't have any more credit cards to fall back on or lines of credit, and I knew I had to do something. I didn't know what to do. And I reached out for help, and I found a community of people that were willing to help me. They're willing not to judge me for what I had done, and they were willing to help me have a better future. And it proved successful for me. I tried quitting gambling on my own half a dozen times over 10 years. Mm. Always found a reason to go back. I was always marketed to. I would get a coupon in the mail for a free room at a casino, and that free room would cost me more than a whole vacation in Aruba. So I always found a reason to go back. Everybody taught me how to gamble. Nobody ever taught me how not to gamble. And I think that's really where, if the state's going to promote sports gambling, they really need to also promote teaching people how not to gamble, that it's okay not to gamble. You don't have to go out and gamble if you don't want to. Or if it turns out that you know someone and you think that they're having a problem, whether it's a financial problem or an emotional problem associated with gambling, that there's resources to reach out to.
Carl, did you play a single hand after that moment of bottoming out? Were you able to make that your last moment of gambling?
I left Turning Stone Casino. It was a Monday morning, December 28th, 2009. And I haven't been to a casino. I haven't played a parlay. I haven't bought a raffle ticket, a scratch-off ticket. I don't play cards with my kids. I don't bet for anything.
Do you feel the urge to do so?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I know that if I started gambling, even if it was a little bit, whether it's a scratch off or going into OTB, that there's a distinct possibility that I would fall down that slippery slope, and it wouldn't take very long.
Let's turn now to an undercovered part of American history. It's a story of Indian dispossession, and it happened in Western New York. In the 1960s, the federal government built the massive Kinzua Dam on the Allegheny River. The dam was designed to control flooding downstream in cities like Pittsburgh.
But to build it, engineers had to take Indian land and had to flood roughly a third of the fertile farmland of the Seneca Nation. Families were forced out. A new documentary film called Lake of Betrayal tells the story. In this clip, you'll hear Peter Jemison, historian for the Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganondagan. And then you'll hear Michael Leroy Oberg, a history professor at SUNY Geneseo.
What struck me, Evan, just in my memories, was I guess the lack of bitterness that I encountered when I was there 10 years after the fact, that people had gone back to living and working and doing whatever they had to do to, you know, to survive. And, you know, I never heard these expressions of anger and bitterness, at least to me. Now, you know, they may have voiced them at home and voiced them in other situations. People lamented that they had to give up their way of life, what they called their way of life, because living really in a really the beautiful part of Allegheny, the mountains with the river and fertile lands, areas where our medicine plants grew and all that sort of thing, you know, people really lamented that. And those who lived closest to our longhouse, which is our traditional way of life, you know, now that they were separated from that, they lamented that part. But it was not the bitterness that you might expect after, you know, you watched your house burn to the ground.
I want to turn to Professor Oberg because I want to make sure that we're setting the table correctly here historically. And you go back, and the film does this as well. You start with those 1936 floods in Pittsburgh, and Congress, you know, sees the floodwaters out their own windows, saying, "Well, I guess we should do something here." But let's make sure we understand exactly what we mean when we talk about breaking treaties, the Canandaigua Treaty, the agreement that should have stood. Give me the sense of the landscape at the time and where families were living and what was happening when the 1930s hits and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers makes this recommendation, and ultimately leading to the 1960s and the building of this dam.
Well, flood control was necessary in many cities. These floods were catastrophic and destructive. There were always alternatives to flooding a third of the Allegheny Reservation, and those proposals were out there. The Army Corps of Engineers never took those proposals seriously. They would have been actually less expensive and perhaps equally as effective as the Kinzua Dam. It would have involved channeling waters through existing creek systems out to Lake Erie rather than damming the Allegheny River. I think the key treaty in this whole discussion is the Treaty of Canandaigua, the 1794 treaty between the Six Nations of the Iroquois, but primarily the Senecas and the United States. And the key articles, the key article in the Treaty of Canandaigua, November 11, 1794, said that the Senecas, but also the other Iroquois nations, had the right to the free use and enjoyment of their lands. That's it. The United States claimed no authority to intrude on that. Their lands were theirs until they chose to sell them. Forever. Yeah. There wasn't even a need for that word, right? It was
free use.
Free use and enjoyment for as long as they want to use it. And I think what you have to do, and I think taking the broader picture, right, is to look the Kinzua and the dam. To me as a historian, it can't be separated from what was going on with the Robert Moses Parkway, and which resulted in the flooding of a good chunk of the Tuscarora Reservation near Lewiston, Lockport, Niagara Falls, that area, the St. Lawrence Seaway, which flooded Akwesasne lands, and to some extent, you know, this sort of corporate industrial pollution that fouled Onondaga Lake, which we're still dealing with after a century of you know, toxic stew. And I think one of the constants, when I tell my students, one of the constants in New York state history is the state of New York, right? The state of New York couldn't have become the Empire State without a systematic program of Indian dispossession. And from the treaty period up to the present, what you see is the state casting covetous glances to reservations, looking to skim the cream of any prosperity that takes place there, whether it was the land in the 18th, 17th, and 18th century, whether it was oil in parts of Seneca country in the second half of the 19th century. You know, even looking at the tribe's economic enterprises today, gaming at Seneca and Oneida, cigarette sales throughout Indian country, the state is always looking at a way to pry whatever prosperity comes to the lands of Haudenosaunee people. It's just a constant.
And so when you talk about alternatives, the film explores what, I don't want to say competing engineers or competing experts were saying, but clearly, the U.S. government seemed sort of hell-bent on doing this one way or another. It didn't get started, though, until 1960, and there are various points, if you don't know the history, that you thought, well, maybe the Seneca Nation would have a chance here. Maybe the JFK would end up being sort of the ally that he promised to be, or maybe there would be a compelling public case to be made. There's a very, to me, one of the saddest moments of what is a sad film was the clip from To Tell the Truth, the game show, that just listening to the audience reaction of seeing someone in a headdress, people laughing. I mean, like what we've done to culture, that's probably a whole other discussion. But Peter, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that because at that time period, we felt, Senecas felt and others felt, that unless you wore that plain style full headdress, people wouldn't accept the idea that you're an Indian. You had to look Indian,
sure,
in other words.
Sure, but why are people laughing?
Well, they're laughing because they're uncomfortable and they don't really know how to deal with the fact that Indians are here in the present, we're there in the present, and this was not part of a film, a Western. This was them trying to bring a point across. It's a shame that Cornelius Seneca had to go on a game show to get those few minutes at the end to explain or have the host explain that he was there to bring to their attention the possibility of the flooding of the land, you know, by this Kinzua Dam. And so, you know, this is like the kind of, what I want to call it, theater that we would have to construct in order to have our point get across to, whether it's a congressman or whether it's on a TV show or whatever it may be. And you know, this is, unfortunately, this is just the level of ignorance that we're talking about, is that the average person on the street knows nothing about this. And trying to educate them and trying to figure out how do you get the broader message out at a time period when certainly media was not available, not anywhere near what today it might be available.
Let's close the week with a question. Do middle school students know what a phone booth is? Somehow this week, that question came up on the show.
I loved this conversation. We had sixth grade students from Rochester who were painting murals around town, but we got a little distracted on the show. Here are students Zach Noor and Natalia Barone trying to figure out what a phone booth might be.
You guys know what a phone booth is?
No.
They do. We were talking about rotary phones today.
Yeah, hold on. Zach said no. What's a phone booth, Zach?
It's the thing where you like...
Hold on, no. This is an important moment.
And then it's on the pole, and then you have to call a number. And then pick it up.
I think I know what a telephone booth is.
I think he's talking about the TARDIS.
I think he is. He is. I think you're on the trail.
So it's a booth, and it has a phone that is connected to the string thing.
A string thing, yes.
Yeah, string thing. And then you have the numbers, and you type in the phone number, and I think you have to pay to use it.
Yes.
Don't you have to pay like a quarter or a dime?
Yeah, that's right. There's a quarter slot there. What is that? Does that seem strange to you, Natalia?
Yeah.
The string thing. What do you think that string thing is?
I don't really know.
Yeah. It's like for like, oh my God.
Of all the valuable things we've talked about this hour, this is the least substantive, but definitely the most fascinating to me. Zach, get his hand up. Go ahead, Zach. We're just diverting totally now, but go ahead, Zach. Roll with it.
Isn't it like an electricity thing that brings electricity?
Yes, this is in the world before cordless or wireless. Yes, indeed. Does anybody know what a rotary phone is? Okay, we'll do that on a different day. And that is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Someday soon we may do a show all about what middle school students think various things are. We were going to talk about a rotary phone. They seem to have no idea.
Fax machines. What's a fax machine?
Our building still has a fax machine.
We do. And I have a pencil sharpener. Who uses pencils anymore?
My six-year-old son uses pencil sharpener. So I think they would know what that is. We'll come up with a list.
Yeah. Listeners, send us your suggestions.
8 tracks.
Oh, 8 tracks. I remember
no
that.
No idea what 8 tracks are.
Connections at WXXI.org. Send us what you want to
hear
students
talk about.
We're
going to build our list and we'll bring them back here. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will talk to you Monday.